Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're back with Professor Matthew England from Sydney, Australia, talking about those crazy floods. He's raised the issue that oceans may be warming even though we don't feel extra heat on land. Yeah, I think you raise a really good point because many of us may not be feeling all that hot where our weather is right now, but it just keeps building and building and building in the ocean, and we expect 50, 100 years from now this heat is still going to be coming out of the seas. Is that correct?
Yeah, look, this issue is complicated because even the fact that we have a seasonal cycle on the planet, you mentioned the cold weather that parts of the US and North America and Canada and Europe have experienced this winter. I mean, every single year we have a summer and winter cycle, and psychologists have surveyed people, and coming out of summer, you know, the acceptance of global warming science is markedly higher than when people come out of winter, and that's ridiculous in some sense because we know that the seasonal cycle has been there since the planet first formed billions and billions of years ago. The seasonal cycle does not change the basic science of global warming. A cold winter here or there is what we expect to continue seeing, but the overall picture of a gradually warming planet, decade by decade, a warming planet is what we're expecting to see, and it's exactly what we've seen for the past century and what we're projecting to see over the next century, unless emissions of greenhouse gases come right down.
Professor England, the floods are surprising some of us outside Australia. We just absorb the images of long-standing drought and bushfires. How can global warming cause drought and flooding?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. The way global warming will work, and all of the models agree on this on a kind of global scale, is that the tropics will tend to get wetter as we go forward in time, and we've seen that. An example of that over Brazil and parts of Queensland and Northern Australia this summer. Whereas in the subtropics, and what I mean by that is that's the sort of latitudes that are about 30 to 40 south and 30 to 40 north, those latitude bands are expected to dry progressively over the next 50 to 100 years, and then further towards the high latitudes, like up towards 50, 60 north and 50, 60 south, we're seeing increased precipitation. That's a bit of a mouthful for your listeners to digest, but the bottom line, the shorter way to put this is that the world's hydrological cycle is expected to be enhanced and increased and invigorated under global warming, and you know, the average hydrological cycle is one of high rainfall at the tropics. We have the desert latitudes at about 30 to 40 or 30 south, 30 north, and then we have much higher rainfall at about 60 south and 60 north. Now, those latitude bands of high rain, low rain, high rain, we're expecting them to be even enhanced. So where it's already wet now, it'll be even wetter. Where it's dry, it'll tend to be drier. So for Australia, the example you mentioned, by and large, the region south, along the south of Australia, so parts of Victoria where we had severe bushfires only a couple of years ago of the order of 50 or so fatalities. That part of Australia, by and large, we're expecting to become drier. To the north in the tropics, we're expecting to become wetter. And this will progress gradually, and of course there are always year-to-year variations. The current La Nina has seen a downpour of rain over Victoria, where only 2 years ago they had severe bushfires, and this is just a La Nina cycle superimposed on the long-term average. So people are forever confusing long-term trends, decade-by-decade trends, with year-to-year variations, and even the seasonal cycle. I mean, there's nothing more ridiculous than hearing a radio commentator here in Australia or elsewhere come along on a cold day and say, gee, it's a cold day, where's global warming today? This is just such a misunderstanding and a confusion between weather, which is day-to-day variations, and climate, which is the long-term, decade-to-decade progression of the climate system.
Yeah, I'd expect my dog or cat to make that mistake, but hopefully not humans. We know that winter and summer come, but the overall pattern of it is what we're talking about with climate change. Now, the business newspapers mainly reported on the loss of coal exports as railways flooded out. I wonder, what will it take before Australians themselves demand an end to coal exports to save what's left of a dependable climate? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was a really ironic aspect of this that some of the coal mines actually flooded as well, and there was a sort of a ceasing of operations there for a while, and I mean a lot of businesses were hit, but to see Australia still so reliant on coal and to see the rate at which politicians are pushing forward changes on that front is concerning. Australia has among the highest per capita emissions of greenhouse gases on this planet. And the time for us to position for a new economy with low carbon technologies, solar power, for example, is a fantastic potential resource here for Australia. You know, the time for us to move to these technologies is now, and you know, we can't wait for other nations to change. The writing's on the wall that the world economy is going to go towards low carbon. So there are some very, very good policymakers trying to push this through at the moment in Australia, trying to convince the electorate that the way to go is to put a price on carbon and to drive innovation in the renewable energy sector. I've been on a report recently that's being submitted directly to the Prime Minister and Cabinet that makes these very specific recommendations about trying to position for a low-carbon economy for the future, securing Australia's climate. We already live in a very harsh environment for our climate. If we go on in a climate change world, we're going to see even more extremes and more costly infrastructure required to deal with things like severe droughts and bushfires and floods and so on. So there are moves in the right direction by people with all the right intentions. My concern is that we still have the electorate, you know, when it comes to elections here in Australia, we still have politicians getting pretty short sound bites in there, like, you know, say no to a carbon tax and let's not put a price on carbon. This is just the government's ripping you off. There's a real fear campaign out there trying to derail the process. And it's having an effect because the average person on the street doesn't necessarily appreciate the scale of the climate problem. They don't appreciate the kind of costs we're going to have in the future. And they also have a fear that a price on carbon will ruin the economy, when in fact folks like Nick Stern and Ross Gunnow here in Australia have shown that putting a price on carbon should drive a growth in the economy, not hamper progress.
Really, it would be beautiful to see Australia powered by all that solar power that you do have, and to be a world leader in exporting sustainable energy instead of coal. Our guest has been Professor Matthew England from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You want to get to heaven, let me tell you what to do. Just mix yourself some industrial stew. Slop it all over your lovely land, and then export it to others. That's the plan, and when you're done, you'll be extinct. I mean gone. Like the dinos and the dodos. So how'd we get into this awful mess? I mean, can't we rely on scientists to tell us how to stay away from trouble and fix those problems on the double? I mean, why not have solar and wind power, electric cars, ecological farms? Well, you know, big business is slow to change, and to slow things more, they try to arrange it. So politicians owe them lots for getting elected and being big shots. At least they act like big shots. You and I know who pulls their chains. So if an oil company owns a president, he ain't likely to call for disarmament, because there's nothing big oil likes more than war. What else are all those big vehicles for than riding all over the desert, dropping bombs, all looking for one guy? I mean, 200,000 soldiers all out looking for one guy. John Wayne must be rolling in his grave. Now the problem in the rest of the global village is that nobody's looking at the dire image of oceans rising and forests burning. I mean, why think of that when you're all yearning for a trip to Cuba or someplace else warm, like Tuk to Yuk Tuk?
It feels like a giant spider is making a web all over the world. The system is growing everywhere. Billions of people rush from sustainable lives in the countryside to slums, factory jobs, and refrigerators. Strangely, this development matrix seems to be collapsing in the center in America, just as it surges into life everywhere else. And there is an emptiness that invites us all to escape. I did, for a while. William Powers did, and who is he? Google tells me about an American from Long Island, an international development and aid worker in poorer countries, a man concerned with the extinction of people, languages, and nature. William Powers' writing appears in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and many other places. He's got degrees from Brown University and Georgetown School of Foreign Service. He's even worked for the World Bank, and we'll forgive him for that. Bill is now a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. But William Powers had to leave all that to find himself in a 12-by-12 cabin in North Carolina, a place with no power, no address, and a creek with no name. Bill, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock. I've been reading your new book, 12-by-12, with interest and a little sadness because I badly miss my own self-built cabin on the hill in a wild spot of Canada. I spent 10 years off the grid. So why was this cabin just 12-by-12?
Well, the 12-by-12, 12-feet-by-12-feet dimensions has to do with the fact that if it's more than 12-by-12, you are legally required in the state of North Carolina to install plumbing and electricity and also to pay property taxes. If it's 12-by-12 or smaller, you don't have to do any of that. So it's a great way to extract yourself from the system.
I wanted to ask you, too, you've had lots of opportunities. You could have done almost anything, but you went back to live in a small cabin before writing this book, 12-by-12. Why did you do that?
Part of it was because of coming back after 10 years abroad, you know, working in so-called developing countries around the world, indigenous cultures, on conservation and aid projects, and then realizing that the very heart of the system, the heart of environmental destruction, is my own country. It was like discovering the thief, and the thief was me. Like that, and it was a feeling of guilt and a feeling of, you know, how do we change this system? And it was at that point when I met a very inspiring physician who I call Jackie Benton in the book 12-by-12. Actually, her name is different, but she asked me to change it to protect her privacy. And she's a physician who could earn, you know, over $250,000 a year, but she only accepts a small amount of that, gives the rest back to the hospital, and is living a subsistence lifestyle right in the middle of the U.S. in a 12-by-12 cabin.
So is it still possible to escape from the heart of empire?
Well, it's not the 1800s, and you can't really be Thoreau going back to Walden Pond. As I found out, living for a season in her 12-by-12, you could smell the waft from the chicken factories, the stench of that, and you could hear this sonic boom of military jets flying right over the cabin, rippling No-Name Creek. So you can't extract yourself from globalization. But what you can do is become a wildcrafter. You know, you can begin to shape your hobbies, your profession, and your community in harmony with the biosphere's limits. And that's what I discovered in, you know, as you say, backwater North Carolina, was that in the old sort of plantations where there used to be slaves and then tobacco, those have become empty spaces, and people are filling those empty spaces with organic farms and permaculture experiments and all kinds of exciting things. And they're living on the creative edge of balancing the human need to do things and to be social and to create, but they're doing it in a way that's in harmony with nature.
I want to get back to that positive side in just a minute, because it's so easy to characterize Americans, to put down America. But in fact, in my travels and in all of the 48 states, I met wonderful, kind people who looked after me. So, you know, I'm always keeping that in mind when I talk about these things. But I couldn't escape the death culture. Even in Canada, I had a uranium mine near me with tailing ponds not too far from the cabin, and there were a lot of reminders. You did talk in your book about the chicken culture. I mean, it's making us fat, and these factory farms are pretty terrible. Could you compare just briefly those birds' lives in the dark with the wild and domestic birds you met in North Carolina?
Right. So I had the unfortunate pleasure, you might say, of visiting one of these chicken factories, part of the Gold-Kissed Empire, it's Pilgrim's Pride. And these chickens live in absolutely horrid conditions in the darkness for 28 days or 35 days until they're slaughtered. And it's absolutely something you definitely do not want to see. In contrast, my neighbors, the Thompsons, who live next to the 12-by-12 and a little farm that they've started there, they were raising a genetic variety of free-range chickens, which they were selling. And it was just, you know, the contrast could not be greater, you know. And I said to people, like, if you're ever even thinking about buying non-free-range organic chicken at the supermarket, I mean, think again. You know, even though you have to pay a little bit more, or maybe even quite a bit more, maybe buy a little bit less and eat less and be a little bit healthier by eating less and just enjoying every bite and knowing that in every bite you're actually supporting this other kind of a vision.
Well, you've gone way ahead to something I really wanted to ask you about, which is using the household budget. You talk about decolonizing from the matrix in a way, and your friend said declare independence from the corporate global economy with the household budget. How can we do that?
Right. Well, I believe that it's definitely possible to vote, and not just with your ballots on election day, but to vote with your dollars for the kind of world you want to live in. So the household budget, every single penny that you spend is either saying yes to a sustainable, durable, soft world, or it's saying yes to a flat world, a world that rewards monoculture and a one-world uniplanet. You have that power every time you open your wallet. So that's the point. It's a kind of a obvious point in a way, but a lot of people kind of forget about it because it's so easy just to kind of buy that fast food or go to Walmart or whatever it is. But imagine that you could, over this next year, think about each dollar you're spending. You know, each time you spend something, just think about, okay, what kind of world is this voting for? And then making the right choices. Even on the web, you know, you can buy on etsy.com, you can buy from local artisans instead of buying from big box store. And there's neighborgoods.net where you're exchanging goods with your neighbors instead of going out and buying new stuff.
Well, I may have to give up on Amazon now that they've abandoned WikiLeaks, but that's just my politics. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest and author, aid worker, William Powers. We are chewing over his latest book, 12 by 12, A One-Room Cabin Off the Grid and Beyond the American Dream. Now, another thing I found in your book, Bill, was the importance of happiness and that those with the most stuff don't necessarily have that happiness. Can you talk to us about that?
That's right. So we often think that money buys happiness, but if you look at the science, the social science behind it, it doesn't. Happiness peaks at a gross domestic product of around $9,000, the level of Chile, Puerto Rico, other countries like that. After that, it plateaus. So for each additional unit of economic growth, you're not getting more well-being for the population. So we have to ask ourselves, what's an economy for anyway? You know, is it just to create more economic throughput and more money for the richest people? And by the way, here in New York City, where I'm talking to you right now, the wealthiest person last year made $6 billion. He's a hedge fund trader. You know, that's something like $2,000 an hour. No, it's more than that. It's a lot of money. Or do we want to be creating something else?
I was thinking when I was living at the edge of the woods, we worked really hard all summer. We could make a few bucks when there were some tourists around, and we had to grow all our food and put it away and then get that wood pile ready and stacked up. But then the whole community wasted away that long winter. We were visiting and drinking tea and daydreaming and talking by the fireside. Hardly anybody has the time to think anymore, and maybe that's why we don't. Do you think there's a conspiracy to use up every second of our lives?
There's a definite time poverty in our culture, and we have to find ways to create time wealth. And there's a lot of ways to do that. One is by, and I jokingly say, that you should work 24/7, meaning 24 hours a week, 7 months a year. You know, and that's 24/7 is a good rule of thumb. See if you can set up your life in a way that the streams of income that you have are enough in just working 24 hours a week, 7 months a year, to meet your expenses. A lot of people I know are doing that. And that's a huge act of rebellion, to take back your time, to find this leisure ethic that people are living with around the world in your own lives. There's no reason why we can't do it in our own society. I've been doing that recently. You know, I've really been scaling back my work creating time. And part of it is like what you're saying, what you saw in that cabin when you were living out there is what I saw also in the 12 by 12, is the fact that people have a lot of free time. And the other thing is also in subsistence cultures, because I worked for 10 years in subsistence cultures, the average campesino or farmer, independent farmer in a developing country like Guatemala or Bolivia, they actually are not slaving away as people are commonly associating. They tend to work rather short hours and also according to their whim. So a certain day they might, you know, put up the poles for a new house. The next day, you know, I kind of feel like harvesting some corn, whatever it is. So the work they're doing is actually just spontaneously in accordance with their soul, what they feel like doing at that time. And I think actually one of the greatest things about the 21st century economy is that we actually do have a lot of that independence now because there's so much sort of outsourcing and there's ways of integrating your skills into the economy in ways that allow you to have that freedom and flexibility.
24/7, I'm going to remember that. You worked in Bolivia, helping to build a community there in the deep Amazon. And Pachamama is the new movement code word that I'm hearing even in the climate movement. What does that really mean to the original people who believe in it?
Pachamama is the Mother Earth. So in Quechua and Aymara cosmology, it's the supreme god, which is our own planet, our host planet that sustains us. So, for example, in Bolivia, and I lived for 6 years in Bolivia, whenever you take a drink, you first pour a little bit onto the ground, and then you take a drink, because you're offering a little bit to Pachamama first. Everyone does this. And, in fact, nowadays, even here in the States, I always just dip my finger in the drink and then just, like, sort of squirt a little bit onto the ground. I don't want to pour it onto someone's rug, you know. But I continue that practice of honoring Pachamama.
Well, that leads to something else I've been puzzled about. Life has been very good to me. I've had unbelievable opportunities. I've found love, and I'm often happy despite all the horrible things I know are going on in the world. So my question, Bill Powers, and you talk about this in the book, do we have to believe in God to be religious, to be grateful? And if not, who or what are we being grateful to?
No, we don't have to believe in a monotheistic God, but yes, gratefulness is important. I think we're grateful for the present moment, for life itself, for the spontaneous manifestation of so many forms around us, yourself, your loved ones, the planet, everything. That doesn't have to be theistic. In fact, the three major monotheistic religions are tied in with the advent of reading silently. Like, the ability to read without moving your lips is a relatively recent thing that started in the Middle Ages. And the voice in our heads today, like, that you probably are quite well aware of, this continuous loop of mind, is tied with that ability. So I think in some ways, you know, the major religions, they're the religions of the book, you know, of the book, of the word. And I think in some ways, like, the original religion, or the true spirituality, is beneath the word. It's what my friend David Abram calls becoming animal. That's his new book. It's called Becoming Animal. It's the idea of coming back into our carnality, into our bodies, and perceiving the world through that and not just through our mind.
Another step that I really identified with that you took in the book was the need to keep an eye for self-criticism as we journey towards this more meaningful life. I've met some pretty self-satisfied alternative type people, and I've kind of been that person myself, even though we've only taken baby steps. How can we keep that humility to know our real and very limited role in our short time here on Earth?
Well, one thing is you can practice rule number six. And rule number six is don't take yourself so damn seriously. And if you ask me what rules 1 through 5 are, rules 1 through 5 are C rule number 6. So the idea is, you know, lighten up. We don't need to take ourselves so seriously. That's part of what Dr. Jackie Benton taught me, that I talk about in 12 by 12, you know, the fact that you can just become simple. The classic Taoist master is a very ordinary person. Dr. Benton's an ordinary person. You might meet her and you might just think, she's no one special, you know, but she's a master. And I think it just comes from just being a creature among creatures. You know, it comes from watching nature. Everything else has its place, you know, and just be ordinary.
And Dr. Benton, despite her giving life of caring for poor people, had established a very low effort but expressive garden all around your 12 by 12 cabin. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Right, like, she didn't want gardening to become another ego extension, like, oh, look at my amazing heirloom tomatoes. Instead, it was more like an expression of simplicity. You know, she did have 100 or 200 varieties of crops growing, but it was done in a way through permaculture design that things would shade each other out to prevent weeds. A lot of it was mostly native plants that don't need a whole lot of irrigation and so on. So she was actually able to travel for periods of time, and everything was on autopilot. So she didn't want to become the burden of her garden. It's like Thoreau said, you know, someone tried to offer Thoreau a welcome mat for his cabin at Walden, just like a little doormat. And he said he refused it. And he said, I'd have to shake it out if I had that. You know, and she's got the same idea that really it's about simplicity, both in your possessions and also in your hobbies.
The other thing I found in my time in my cabin was that I experienced absolute silence from time to time, and I claim that few city dwellers have ever heard it. When the snow was 8 feet deep, there was nothing around me. There were no planes flying overhead. I couldn't hear any highway noise, and I had no electricity, so there were no machines coming on and off in my house. Absolute silence, and it's so good, I can still hear it now.
Oh, it is so wonderful, Alex. I can hear it as well, and it is such a blessing to have that time. I experienced it in Africa when I was living in these remote villages, South America, in the 12x12, and it's divine.
You left that 12x12 cabin in North Carolina. Why, and where did you go?
Well, you know, some things are just meant to touch our lives for a certain period of time, and I spent one season there, and then I went back to doing aid work. I went back to West Africa for a period, went back to Bolivia, and then I started working at a think tank in New York City to try to bring to scale some of these ideas. In fact, part of what I do now is I bring this discussion of what's your 12x12 to audiences. Just now, I just came out of a lecture with Fulbright scholars from other countries here in the U.S., and I'm taking that message around to people and using this institute as kind of a megaphone for getting some of these ideas out there. So it's like I honestly find it very seductive and would love to still be out there in a way, but I just feel like listening to myself and knowing what my role is, it's not to be there right now.
I tell myself I came back to fight the dragon in its own place. Does that resonate with you at all?
You know, the idea of fighting the dragon is a bit problematic because as soon as you fight something, you're energizing it through that negative energy or that like resistance. So I think that really part of what I learned in the 12x12 and also for indigenous cultures is if you can bring about another consciousness level where you're not fighting it, but you're just kind of creating something new, it's much more powerful. So she would say, where do you grab the dragon's tail? You know, so it's like, I picture that as like many people, hundreds of people, each grabbing the tail somewhere. So it's kind of not a direct fighting, but you're sort of holding on and coming together to do that.
As we finish up, is there something more you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, just that it's very difficult to escape your habits. And a lot of people probably feel like, you know, I like my life, or it's good. But it's good to remember two things. One is that if everyone lived at the level of the average North American, Canadians and Americans, we'd need 4 or 5 additional planets to sustain everyone, you know? And also the fact that we're losing a culture every fortnight around the world, you know, because of the globalization model. That's one thing. And the other is there's a lot of joy to be found in simplifying. You know, bust your clutter, get down to the basics, simplify. You'll find have much more time and freedom to be yourself and to give to others, and you'll be more happy. So there's two things. One is the negative thing, that it's not sustainable, this Western lifestyle. And two is there's a better way. So why not try it out? Some of the things that we've been talking about that you talk about in your other programs, start implementing those one by one, and that's how we'll see the change happen.
Living outside the machine. I'm still poring over a couple of chapters of your book, Bill, and the handy sayings inside. It's William Powers with a new book, 12x12, A One-Room Cabin Off the Grid and Beyond the American Dream. It's pretty cheap in paperback and the kind of book that you want to pass around to friends. Find out more at Bill's website, williampowers.com. Thank you, Bill. And
yeah, actually, it's williampowersbooks.com.
Oh, williampowersbooks.com. Okay,
yeah.
We got that. Thanks so much, and keep Radio EcoShock in mind if you have another story for us, would you?
I will certainly do that, Alex. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. I'm Alex Smith. Our website is ecoshock.org. That song, Talking Global Warming, was by longtime musical activist Smokey Dimney.